Midlands Today with Tullamore Oval, Church Road, Tullamore. Time to cross over the new Mokka. Test drive your 231 Opel Mokka at Tullamore Motors, Church Road, Tullamore. See tullamoremotors.ie. Midlands Today with Ronan Berry on Midlands 103.
Good morning. How are you all doing on this Tuesday, the 15th of November? Little bit more of a November feel to the morning, you might think, out there. Around 4 or 5 degrees on the way in. It certainly feels a little bit more normal. You've probably been enjoying those high temperatures, but I suppose still quite warm for the time of year that it is. Coming up between now and midday, we'll be doing our Health Matters Clinic with Emmett Walsh, Medical Herbalist. So if you've got any queries or any questions you'd like to put to our herbalist there, you can do so on 083 3010 103, or you can ring us here at the station as well on 08... you can give us an email here at the studio to studio@midlands103.com. Also, we're going to look at the issue of phone chargers and indeed how they can be quite dangerous if plugged in certain areas, because there was a recent lucky escape for a boy in Donegal, and we're going to bring you some input on that and maybe get you some tips and advice on how to avoid a similar incident happening. Also, we will throughout the show, if we can get a chance as well, pay a tribute to the late Vicky Phelan. And we'll have a piece too from Dennis Nocton around vacant property grants too. That and a whole lot more coming up between now and midday. And if you were a gun owner too, did you know that your gun licence is possibly due for renewal there? And there's some kind of important information that you should know about that. And later on we'll be joined by Sergeant Graham Kavanagh just to fill you in on exactly what you need to do to keep you up to speed and indeed keep you compliant and keep the Gardaí away from you. Now, a quick look at what is trending across the nation at the minute. Undoubtedly, the first thing that pops up on every paper and on every news channel, and rightly so, is the sad passing of Vicky Phelan. The heartbroken husband and children of the Cervical Check campaigner have paid a heartbreaking tribute to her. The 48-year-old's death yesterday, she passed away in the Milford Hospital in Limerick, has prompted a wave of condolences both nationally and indeed across the globe. But her husband Jim and their children Amelia and Dara have paid, as they, the most heartfelt tribute to her. They've said it has been an immense burden of grief that earlier today we bade our final farewell to our beloved Vicky. She was the heart and soul of our family unit, and her passing will leave a void in all our lives that at this point seems impossible to fill. We cherish the memories of a loving wife, mother, daughter and sister whose ability to deal with the struggles of life has inspired not only ourselves but an entire nation. The outpouring of grief and good wishes from far and wide are truly appreciated. Now, just to remind you, Miss Phelan was given an incorrect smear test result in 2011 and developed cervical cancer in 2014 and was only given a short period of time to live. But she'd settled a High Court action for almost €2.5 million in April 2018 against Clinical Pathology Labs, the US laboratory used by Cervical Check. She then refused to sign a confidentiality agreement and disclosed her discovery of an internal Cervical Check look-back audit showing how some women who went on to develop cancer had incorrect readings telling them that they had no abnormalities. The fallout from her battle for justice led to revelations that over 221 women were impacted by incorrect smear test results, and it led to an overhaul of the Cervical Check. The 221 women affected by the scandal in their family said she had spoken out because she wanted those in power to learn from her mistakes. Indeed, one of Vicky Phelan's closest friends, Stephen Teep, who himself had lost his wife Irene after the Cervical Check blunders, said yesterday too that we all knew this day would come and you can never prepare yourself for it. He went on to add that she was a courageous person, a very caring and loving friend who had a great sense of humour. People loved to be in her company. My boys Oscar and Noah were very fond of her. He described her magnetic presence and told how you always felt safe and secure in her company. And those tributes continued from far and wide. President Michael D. Higgins said she had faced her own illness with strength and dignity, while also making an enormous contribution to Irish society. Thanks to her tireless efforts, despite the terrible personal toll she herself had to carry, so many women's lives have been protected and will be protected in the future, the President said. High praise indeed. And those sentiments were echoed by people all across the media, through government and, as I say, far and wide and beyond. But that tribute there from Michael D. Higgins that I think really sums up and the power that she had. And I think for anybody that knew of her story, and I think most of us did, probably find ourselves astounded that she managed to fight that health battle that she had in front of her, to still spend time with her family, that time that she devoted to them, continuing her treatment and continuing that campaign. She was front and centre in many national campaigns on local media, national media, and you do wonder how she managed to do it. But that strength and resolve and resilience that she had, and as we've said there, she has saved undoubtedly the lives of thousands of women potentially there with her action. May she rest in peace. Moving on, the number of county councils are underperforming. Now, some are performing quite well, but this is based on a new report by the Environmental Protection Agency. Kildare, Dublin City, Leitrim, Monaghan and Finglas performed the best in 2021 at contributing to national priorities around waste, water, air and noise and relevant governance processes. Meanwhile, Offaly, Mayo, Sligo, Wexford and Waterford performed the worst or the least well, and based on this survey. Most local authorities performed well in some areas, but some performed well at all 20 national priorities, particularly things like septic tank inspections, tackling illegal waste, air quality monitoring and handling environmental complaints. The report identified that water quality around Ireland is declining and the number of water complaints increased by 14% to 3,600 in 2021. That's based on the Environmental Protection Agency's 2021 report published today titled Focused on Local Authority Environmental Enforcement. Now, no local authority ranked strong or excellent across five categories of water enforcement, but Leitrim, Meath, Monaghan and Wicklow met the required standard in four of the five areas. Six failed, though, to meet any of the required standards for water, including Laois, Mayo, Offaly, South Dublin, Sligo, Waterford City and Waterford County. The best local authorities at air and noise enforcement were Dunleer, Rathdown, Kerry, Kildare and Monaghan, while Louth, Offaly, South Dublin, Sligo and Wexford were the worst. Again, that's based on the report and maybe the terminology there. The worst may be a little bit severe. I'm sure if you look up the full context of that report too, you'll get some actual data and statistics around that. Social Welfare Ireland, exact date of cost of living lump sum will be paid to thousands of people will be confirmed today. Social Protection Minister Heather Humphreys will today brief her colleagues on payment dates for the four lump sums, and these are cost of living measures announced as part of the budget back in September. Over 865,000 people will receive lump sums for the cost of living payments from tomorrow, the Cabinet will hear. These basically €325 million has been put aside to pay these 865,000 older people, people with disabilities and low income families who will receive a lump sum from later this week. A €400 fuel allowance lump sum payment will be paid to 370,000 households from Wednesday, and on Thursday the fuel allowance payment will be paid to those receiving the deserted wives allowance, the deserted wives benefit and the invalidity pension. Those who receive the blind person pension, the guardian payment, the incapacity supplement, the debt benefit, the widow's non-contributory payment, the national fuel scheme, the state pension and the widow's contributory payment will get the €400 fuel allowance on Friday. A €500 lump sum working family payment will be paid to over 44,000 families on Thursday, November the 17th. And the €200 lump sum payment to the 2,234,000 people in receipt of the living alone allowance will be paid to those who receive the disability allowance on Wednesday. So government indeed following up on some of those measures put out there in the budget, and undoubtedly the cost of living is such a topical area for so many people at present. It really, there's nobody that it's not affecting. And when we talk about people and populations and statistics, the world population is set to reach 8 billion today. Is that a cause for celebration? Well, who knows? I mean, certainly the first thing when you think of a growing population is the challenges around food supply and shortages, and maybe the overproduction of food in some parts of the world, and indeed the amount of food waste that a lot of Western and indeed countries will generate. It's a huge topic of debate, while other parts of the world are, as we speak, undergoing drought and famine. So how can that be balanced out? Indeed, how can supply chains be changed or reactivated in order to try to take away from those shortages and indeed those the suffering that causes too? But the population of the world is growing now. This isn't unexpected, has been widely expected for quite a while now. But a baby born today would be the world's 8 billionth person, according to a projection by the United Nations. The milestone is an occasion to celebrate diversity and advancements while considering humanity's shared responsibility for the planet UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said in a statement. Now, the UN attributes the growth to human development, with people living longer thanks to improvements in public health, nutrition, personal hygiene and medicine. Now, it's also the result of higher fertility rates, particularly in the world's poorest countries, most of which are in sub-Saharan Africa, putting their development goals at risk too. Now, population growth has also magnified the environmental impacts of economic development. I just heard earlier this morning, actually, that the glaciers on top of Mount Kilimanjaro are expected to be completely gone by the year 2050, which is quite staggering. I had the pleasure to see them actually with my own eyes about 10 years ago, and they are colossal up at the very top of Mount Kilimanjaro. To think that they could be entirely gone is quite frightening too. But as I say, this whole idea of a growing population, it's happening here in Ireland. We're at a higher level now than we were at any time since before the famine. And you have to bear in mind that at one point over 8.5 million people lived in this country, a lot in, you know, rural settings, and our population is expected to get back towards pre-famine levels at some point in the next number of decades, or maybe certainly over the next 100 years. So this idea of population growth isn't new. I think one other thing to watch out for is that at some point India is going to become the most populous country in the world. It's going to overtake China, and you're talking a couple of billion people there too. So this is definitely happening. So again, all those questions we ask about those little measures we can take or steps we can take on a private level as private citizens, we have to look at the overall global picture too and make sure that we bring that equality as well, and that people aren't left to suffer just because of the excess or the growth of one part of the world too. So plenty of challenges there too. But as the UN have pointed out, there may be, you know, certain risks to sustainability and climate goals for some countries based on rapidly rising populations. Moving on through Ukraine. President Zelensky has addressed the G20 summit, and he has told leaders that Russia-Ukraine war must and can be ended. So is this a hint of maybe a slight change of tact here by Vladimir Zelensky? He's told the G20 leaders in a video address that basically the time has come to bring the war in Ukraine to an end. Now, that statement alone would fill you with a little bit of confidence and indeed hope that it can be brought to an end and at least end the suffering of people who have had this horrific situation inflicted upon them. Addressing world leaders in Bali in his now trademark green t-shirt, President Zelensky said, "I am convinced now is the time when the Russian destructive war must and can be ended. It will save thousands of lives." This is the most influential audience he has addressed since the war started, as he tried to pitch himself as a man prepared to reach an agreement with Russia, but only on terms that protected Ukrainian sovereignty. Again, he was speaking to the Chinese and US presidents, but obviously not to Russian leader Vladimir Putin. He said there are and cannot be any excuses for nuclear blackmail, and pointedly thanked G19, therefore excluding Russia, for making this clear. He accused Russia of trying to build a radioactive bomb at a nuclear power plant that could explode at any moment. So obviously excluding Vladimir Putin from there. And I mean, the silence coming from Russia, well, certainly from our perspective, has been deafening since they withdrew from the Kherson region too. Now, moving on, when it comes to looking at our own health matters, and actually yesterday as we spoke about absentee rates across the health service, doctors and dentists appear to be one of the lowest rates of absenteeism. So another story has emerged today in the Irish Independent about dentists, and it's quite a grabbing headline. I had a patient who lost all her teeth after treatment in Turkey. Irish Dental Association chief warns against trips abroad. So the president of the Irish Dental Association has warned us to do proper research before travelling abroad for treatments after a patient lost all her teeth following a procedure in Turkey. Dr. Caroline Robbins said social media has played a significant role in people wanting to have their teeth done abroad, but she advised that over-treatment can lead to serious issues. I'd say too, maybe cost might be an element in that too. That is generally the primary driver for people to look at treatments overseas. But the Irish Independent spoke to the woman who are now being quoted up, or women who are now being quoted up to €25,000 to repair work done abroad. In some cases, they were made to sign disclaimers stating they would not post negative reviews about the companies online or seek to have corrective surgeries done for free. Between 150,000 and 250,000 people flock to Turkey from other countries every year to have dental work done, according to the Turkish Dental Association. It, of course, has warned that some rogue operators in the country are using cheap materials which may compromise the quality of treatment. Dr. Robbins has said that both good and bad work done in clinics, has seen both good and bad work done in clinics abroad. And, you know, recently treated a patient who incurred problems after having 28 crowns fitted. So a bit like everything, buyer beware is the kind of key message there, and that goes to anything we're doing, particularly when you go online shopping. If you are looking at going shopping online for Christmas, you know, simple tip, look local. Find your local stores, see what they're doing, buy your products locally if you can. But if you are looking at something that you have to go a little bit further afield, just check it. Just get a sense that the website is actually genuine and not bogus. And if that's healthcare you're looking for, or dental treatment or whatever it might be, do your background checks and don't be one of those caught out as well. Up to 8 years sentence for not protecting children from gambling has been proposed under a new law. The Gambling Regulation Bill will come before the Cabinet for approval. You would wonder how children can get exposed to gambling, but unfortunately it seems to be everywhere we look now too. But gambling companies who fail to protect children from accessing their services will face punitive sanctions, including imprisonment of up to eight years under the Gambling Regulation Bill that's due to come before the Cabinet for approval. The bill is the most far-reaching and comprehensive legislation to regulate gambling in the history of the state and will fundamentally change the rules of gambling in the country, both physical gambling and the burgeoning online industry. As well as setting up a powerful gambling regulatory authority, the legislation will introduce a range of sweeping measures to protect consumers, problem gamblers and vulnerable users, especially children. It will not only regulate and circumscribe the activities of gambling companies, but will also set out strict new rules in advertising and sponsorship. That's been brought to Cabinet, or before Cabinet, by Minister for Justice Helen McEntee on behalf of James Brown. And this piece of legislation has taken up most of his time since being appointed Minister of State for Law Reform in 2020. It will reform legislation dating from 1953, which was wholly inadequate to deal with the dramatic changes that have occurred in the gambling industry in the past two decades. It's not an area I'm familiar with at all, but I do see from friends and people who I know who do it, like, you know, that it's become such a almost a real-time thing that not only now are people gambling or putting money on an event, they're actually changing and, you know, changing bets or putting new bets on almost minute by minute, such as the power of social media and influence there too. So again, laws written in 1953 around gambling clearly will not suffice in 2022. Now, so if you are a bit of a gambler, or if you are somebody who likes to scroll on your phone a little bit, maybe sometimes that happens in the kitchen, does it? When you're stirring pots, or you're between washing up and drying, or between loading the dishwasher, whatever it might be. Well, because it looks like we all spend quite a lot of time in our kitchen. A recent UK survey has suggested that people spend nearly 2.5 years of their life in the kitchen. It shows that we spend about 7 hours a week in the kitchen and doing about 300 steps in there a day. I don't know, that to me sounds a little bit low. I think most people possibly do a lot more than that. Of course, it depends on the layout of your kitchen and whether it's the main kind of communal area in your house or whether it is just that kind of workstation that it is for many houses, particularly where people have young family in there too. Did you know the kettle is boiled an average 12 times a week, with people spending 43 minutes a week stirring food? The kettle is boiled an average of 12 times a week. I was going to say 12 times an hour in my house, such as the frequency of cups of tea and coffee. But anyway, I certainly don't agree with that statement anyway. Maybe we're just an outlier in our house. Some good news at last too when it comes to sport. The Aviva Stadium in Croke Park will host 7 Euro 2028 games if the bid is approved. This is good news, particularly as we face into the World Cup starting soon. But the Aviva Stadium in Croke Park could host 7 games between them at the Euro 2028 Championships should the bid be approved by Cabinet on Tuesday. If that bid is accepted by Cabinet and proved successful, as many as 120,000 fans are expected to travel to Ireland for the tournament, which could be worth up to 250 million euro to the economy, based on estimates. Sports Ministers Catherine Martin and Jack Chambers will seek Cabinet approval to submit a formal joint bid to host Euro 2028 along with England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. Both Ministers will ask Cabinet to approve a letter of support to the FAI to allow it to submit a preliminary bid to jointly host a tournament with other football associations. Doesn't that sound amazing? Wouldn't it be fantastic to have Euro 2028, at least have some games and 7 of them based in the Aviva and the Croke Park. Two wonderful stadiums ideally set up to do that. So look, lots happening out there. Still to come on Midlands Today, the phone chargers that you use and indeed how you use them, could it be presenting a real danger to your family if used incorrectly? We'll have more on that a little bit later. Plus we'll have our Health Matters Clinic with Emmett Walsh, medical herbalist. So if you have any questions, you can text or WhatsApp them into us here on 083 3010 103 or drop us an email, studio@midlands103.com. So, say lots more coming up between now and midday too, including some guidance on gun licence if you indeed have a gun and a licence and it needs to be renewed. Some important information we'll bring to you a little bit later too. But a grant of up to €50,000 to refurbish vacant homes has been extended to rural areas. The Vacant Property Refurbishment Grant, which allows buyers to avail of €30,000 in funding and a further €20,000 if the building is derelict, had only been in place in towns and villages. Independent Roscommon Galway TD Dennis Nocton has been speaking to Midlands 103's Cameron Clark. He's hopeful the grant will ease pressure on the housing market.
Well, look, we have tens of thousands of vacant homes right across Ireland, both urban and rural areas. And earlier this year, the Minister for Housing and Local Government, Dara O'Brien, took on board a proposal that I put forward that we would give a €30,000 grant for the refurbishment of vacant property. Now, at the time when this was announced during the summer, it was only for towns and villages. However, this is now going to be extended to houses in rural areas. And there are many of those right across rural Ireland and right across the country where they're lying vacant, where they're close to schools and services. Some of them have 1,000 megabit per second high-speed broadband outside the door. And it makes absolutely no sense in the middle of a housing crisis to have property like this vacant. So the Minister is now extending the grant to homes, both urban and rural homes. There's a €30,000 grant available to refurbish a home that has been vacant for more than 2 years. And if the property is derelict, then there's an additional €20,000 that can be secured. So I would actively encourage people now to contact their local county council. The application has to go through the local county council and engage with them to secure that grant as quickly as possible and hopefully create a new family home in a community where the house is vacant at present, bringing life back into that local community.
Dennis, is there a list of criteria that has to be met for a property to be considered derelict? So obviously take advantage of that extra €20,000.
Yes, so the government have a webpage on their website in relation to the refurbishment grant, and people can log on there and it goes through the whole process outlining the checklist that is needed in relation to draw down the €30,000 grant or the €50,000 grant for a vacant property or for a derelict property.
There are around 8,000 vacant properties in the Midlands, that's Laois, Offaly and Westmeath. That's according to the latest the census figures. Do you expect that this new grant is going to reduce that number significantly?
Well, look, it needs to reduce that number significantly. We have an appalling situation where right across the Midlands we have 8,000 vacant homes. In my own county of Roscommon, we have 4,000 vacant homes. And yet, right across the Midlands, we have a very serious housing crisis where there aren't homes available to rent at the moment. If you go to websites like daft.ie, people are being forced into homelessness because of the lack of accommodation. And it's vitally important that all of these houses are brought back into use so that we can actually accommodate the thousands of people that are on our housing lists at the moment who are desperately in need of secure long-term accommodation.
We are in the middle of a housing crisis. There's been a number of solutions suggested. Derelict properties and taking advantage of them has been one of them since this began. If we're being realistic, do you think this will have a big impact?
Well, look, I'm hoping that it will have an impact and try and see some of these houses being unlocked and opened up. The reality is, because of the change in the housing market, particularly since COVID, these particular properties outside of the major urban centres, particularly where there's broadband in place, are now becoming very popular. And there's an incentive there now for someone that has one of these vacant properties to dispose of it, and a young couple buy that, or, you know, an existing family member who wishes to relocate back into the local area, that they have the opportunity to draw down that grant and bring life back into an old home.
Dennis, this scheme was in place in towns and villages. The news today is that it's been extended to rural areas. Do you know why it took so long for it to be extended to rural areas in the first place?
Well, look, I know that this has taken a while for Minister O'Brien to get it to this stage. I know that initially there was opposition to the introduction of such a grant. But the point that I consistently made to him and to his predecessors was that we're giving €30,000 to developers towards the cost of service sites in our cities. Why are we not prepared to give some financial assistance to open up vacant properties in rural areas? And these are homes that can be turned around quite quickly, bringing life back into rural communities, giving local employment for many small builders, and helping to sustain rural communities, and particularly services such as the local primary schools.
That is Roscommon Galway TD Dennis Nocton there speaking to Midlands 103's Cameron Clark about the vacant property refurbishment grant, which has been extended not just from a certain number of towns but also for rural properties. And I mean, it's absolutely staggering when you drive the roads of their county and you see the amount of derelict properties, not just in Offaly, Leash and Westmeath, but across the wider Midlands region too. So maybe that is an opportunity for people to create homes and indeed help go some way towards solving the housing challenges that currently exist out there. I don't know about you, but I certainly missed award ceremonies. I think we all needed a good reason to get out and celebrate once again. Well, over 300 people gathered to celebrate the return of the Midlands 103 Hospitality Awards last night. The annual event, which was held in the Midlands Park Hotel, recognised those working in the hospitality sector in Leash, Offaly and Westmeath. The big winners on the night included the Collection Port Leash, which was crowned Hotel of the Year, with the Wineport Lodge in Athlone taking the title of Restaurant of the Year. The full list of the 51 winners is available on Midlands103.com. Now, Midlands 103's Chloe Farrell was soaking up the atmosphere, and she begins this report with Liam Gillerin from Gillerin's Bar in Mullingar, which scooped the Pub of the Year again. And Liam says it is down to his staff.
I'm blown away. When you see the award coming towards the end, you're kind of saying to yourself, ah, sure, look, but maybe not this year. And then all of a sudden you're called out, and that's down to judges and the listeners and your customers. I just don't know what to say. For once in my life, I can say I'm actually speechless. Because normally I'm not short of words, but this time I am.
And how long are you in business?
Well, it's a long story and a short story. Born and reared in the pub. And Mary and I bought back the place where now that my father started originally back many, many years ago. He started off in Mullingar in 1960. And he bought where we are now in 1972. And then Mary and I bought it back there about 6 years ago, even though I ran it for my father, along with Mary, for years and years and years. And at the time that was sold, it was very simple. It's just my dad just wanted to retire, and rightly so too, because he had spent maybe nearly 55, 60 years behind the bar counter. So he says, I'm out of here, you know. And I was delighted for him and delighted for all of us. And but the day that we left that place was probably one of the most emotional days of my life, because I could not wait to get back in there again, you know.
Parik Brown, owner, Brown's on the Green restaurant, Terrell's Pass, and Brown's the venue in Tullamore. They mean everything to us, Chloe. So we opened Terrell's Pass 6 years ago, 2016, October 2016. We opened the bistro a year ago, just in, I suppose, at the end of COVID. Everybody said we were mad. And when they finally knew we were mad, we opened Brown's the venue on the 14th of July this year. And actually, it's ironic. We're open 4 months today in the venue, and they've won their first award. So it's, yeah, proud.
And with COVID, some businesses were closing. How were you inspired to open something else?
I suppose my background is farming. We're originally from Watford, and we're farmers. We kill all our own cattle and sheep for the restaurant. So I suppose, to use the old adage, when the sheep are going that way, they generally go the other way. So we just saw an opportunity in Tullamore, and thankfully we've been We've got huge support there from the people of Tullamore Town since we came to Tullamore in both restaurants, and we're so grateful. But yeah, I suppose it was, some people would say, mad. But we just saw two buildings we liked and we just went for it.
Hi everyone, my name is Dom McDermott and I work in the Bridge House Hotel in Tullamore, and I am the wedding coordinator here in Tullamore as well. I've been working in the hotel for the last 10 years. Over different departments, but in the last 5 years I've been the wedding coordinator. So yeah, I'm delighted to get the award tonight. It's great.
And what's involved in your job?
So day to day we're dealing with couples every day. We have wedding show rounds every weekend. We have weddings every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. During COVID I was always working with wedding couples and postponing and moving their weddings, and in the last probably 6 to 8 months we've actually been doing an awful lot of weddings that have been supposed, that were supposed to happen 2 years ago. So we're kind of at the end of our couples now that were supposed to get married during COVID, but definitely over the last 2 years it's been a whirlwind.
My name is Linda and I'm from Molly Moose Pet Farm in Mullingar. Oh, it's amazing. Recognition for all the hard work me and my husband and children do. We're open over 8 years. We have a pet farm just outside Mullingar beside Belvedere House. We have animals, we have llamas, alpacas, geese, sheep, cows, goats, pigs, farm animals. We have crazy golf, we have a playground, we have snakes and ladders, we have a sandbox, we have a cafe, serving pizzas, sandwiches.
What made you start a business like this?
Because we're farming, and farming wasn't viable, so we decided we'd branch out and do something else. So we decided we'd create a business and...
That's the owners of Molly Moo's Pet Farm, one of the winners in the Midlands 103 Hospitality Awards last night. And interesting, as you listen to those pieces, that a few of those businesses, diversity or diversification actually, is what has driven them to where they are now. And particularly, say, from farming, that maybe realising that a farming income as it stood might not have been enough to, you know, support a family or whatever else, so created side businesses. And when you go do that to the extent of companies like Browns on the Green or Browns of Venues or Molly Moo Pet Farm there, it really shows what can be done. Obviously, it takes great people. Everybody there and all the winners last night immediately paid tribute to their staff. And if you just think of the hospitality sector, the challenges it has faced over the past 3 years, it is far from out of the woods yet. But the challenges it has faced for all those people to get together, to be still in business and to be even growing their businesses, or indeed becoming more ingenious with new ways of you know, offering a better customer experience, it is a huge testament to them all. So well done to everybody who was shortlisted by you, the listeners of Midlands 103. There was over 10,000 nominations made for the awards last night, and last night in the Midlands Park Hotel, 51 awards were given out, including some very particularly special awards, including the Albert Award, in memory of our late managing director here, Mr. Albert Fitzgerald. It will be a national award and it will be awarded each year for somebody who shows outstanding abilities for sales and customer service. Very fitting indeed with Albert. You can check out all the winners on midlands103.com and go through the list there and see, and check out all our social medias, because there's lots of pictures and lots of videos from the event last night for you to have a look at. Coming up between now and 11 p.m, the great inflation when it comes to Leaving Cert results. The state's education watchdog is about to investigate the factors behind grade inflation in higher education institutions, as latest figures show record numbers of students are securing first class honours. Sorry, it is higher education there. We'll have a little bit more on that from Betty McLaughlin, former president of the Institute of Guidance Counsellors, later. Also, our Health Matters Clinic with medical herbalist Emmett Walsh is coming up. So if you've got a question or a query you'd like to put to Emmett, you can do so by text or WhatsApp on 083 3010 103. Of course, powered by the home of Offaly's top-selling car brand, Lamb Brothers Toyota, on the Arden Road, Tullamore. Or you can give us a call here at the station on 0818 300 103. We'll also have plenty more news from around the region coming up. But of course, the news, the one story that really has caught all our attentions and really pulled at the heartstrings over the last 24 hours has been the sad passing of cervical Czech campaigner Vicky Phelan. Yesterday on this show, you would have heard Minister of State at the Department of Finance and Laois Offaly TD Sean Fleming pay tribute to Vicky Phelan. Sean was the chair of the Public Accounts Committee at the time that Miss Phelan appeared before it. He described her as being a true heroine of Ireland, a sentiment that was echoed by many all across society over the past 24 hours. And the tributes have continued to pour in for Vicky Phelan. The mum of two was diagnosed with cervical cancer in 2014, 3 years after a smear test showed no abnormalities, which was later found to have been incorrect. In April 2018, she settled a high court action against CPL Labs in the US for €2.5 million without an admission of liability. Her campaigning led to an independent investigation by Dr. Gabriel Scally in 2018. A month after her settlement, she spoke before the Public Accounts Committee on the implications of the cervical check revelations.
Make no mistake about it, I had cancer in 2011. It wasn't pre-cancer, it was cancer. The misdiagnosis in my case, and you know, I know this is not the case for other women in this audit, but in my case, it has cost me my life. I've got terminal cancer. I mean, I don't believe I'm going to die, but, you know, at the end of the day, I'm going to have to fight to live for the rest of my life and go from one treatment option to another until I find something to cure me. But I shouldn't be in this position at all. The big thing for me is the patient's safety. I'm not interested in kind of revenge, you know, that's not what I'm here for. I do want to see accountability, and I would like to see a legacy that this will never happen again to any woman, man or child in this country, because there are, you know, this is not just a woman issue. This is, you know, affecting men and children who are without their mothers and their wives. I never want to see this happen again. And if I do die, you know, I want it to be not in vain, and I want to make sure that there are protocols put in place, sanctions for people who are not accountable, who make these mistakes and are held accountable, and that the HSC is overhauled, and I mean overhauled, you know, from the ground up, so that people are held accountable and that this will never happen again in any shape or form.
And such a dark day for her family, for her husband and her two children. I mean, hearing her saying there that she hopes her death won't be in vain, I think we can absolutely agree that hasn't happened. Now, she has called there in that speech from a few years back for complete reform of the health service. And if you were listening to the show yesterday, you would have heard into leader Padraig Tobin kind of reiterate similar kind of sentiments, indeed, based on absenteeism level within the health service at present. So, again, it's a constant theme, isn't it, there, that need for maybe potential overhaul, and to ensure, as you heard Vicky saying there, that this doesn't happen to other people, because, you know, as well as affecting the actual patient, that has a devastating impact on families, friends, and indeed the wider community too. But in continuing to pay tribute to Vicky Phelan and how she inspired strength in women with cancer, that's according to a Midlands Cancer Support Centre. The manager of Lark Cancer Support Centre in Multifarnham, Bernie McHugh, was speaking to Midlands 103's David Hollywood and says the Limerick woman's legacy will be far-reaching.
Yeah, she's leaving behind a huge legacy, I suppose. I'll start by offering this our sincerest sympathies on behalf of myself and the staff of Cancer Support Sanctuary Lark and the board of directors to her family and friends, wide circle of friends and her immediate family. It's a terrible loss. She chose to use her diagnosis and to use the fact that she had been wrongly that her smears were missed. She used that opportunity to shout it from the rooftops and advocate for change in the system, helping those of other women to gain the strength to do the same, and really calling out the awfulness of what went so wrong. And I suppose the legacy she leaves behind is one of, you would hope, improvements in screening, improvements in the labs and their diligence around these areas, and improvements in general women's health going forward. I mean, she has fed into so many working groups and reports that we know of that will, you know, will help hopefully to improve things in women's health in general. And she did that. She chose not to stay quiet. She chose to go public and stay in the public arena and have her voice heard very loudly for all of that time. And she, for that, we will be eternally grateful to her. She leaves behind a huge legacy.
She was a remarkably effective campaigner. But why do you think this story is resonating so uniquely with people?
Because Vicky could be anyone's sister or, you know, cousin, or she was an ordinary person who got caught up in an extraordinary set of circumstances that led to, you know, a campaign, you know, against what went wrong, and she, as you say, she chose to not sign the non-disclosure and to go public with the whole thing. So she became an extraordinary advocate. I think it's her age at the time of diagnosis, the sadness of the fact that if it was caught in time, her outcome could have been so much different, and the screening mishaps is the reason that wasn't the case for her. And, you know, and for so many, she shone a light, which brought so many cases to the fore. And I think it was just her age and the young children, you know, when she was diagnosed, and the fact that she decided to go public and be such an advocate. You couldn't but admire her. And as I said, she could be anyone's cousin, sister, you know, friend. And you just, if she was, you would have been so proud of how she had conducted herself. The commentary all day is about how she kept her sense of humour and her dignity and her sense of life and living throughout the whole thing. And that's, you know, that's to be so admired. You know, it's such a strong trait in her. She was, you know, she wasn't blessed in how she had her, all her mishaps and her misdiagnosis, but she was certainly blessed with the strength to carry on the story and to shout it from the rooftops and get as much done as she did in her time since diagnosis. It's to be admired. She fought tooth and nail to be around for as long as she could for her family as well. Huge dignity, huge personal strength, person of integrity. You would have been proud to have known her, and those that have met her have been saying that all day, how they feel privileged to have met her in her lifetime.
That's Bernie McHugh there, the manager of Lark Cancer Support Centre in Multifarnham, speaking to Midlands 103's David Hollywood earlier this morning on the sad passing of Vicky Phelan. And again, it just, you know, every time you hear a tribute to her, you just get those, that overwhelming sense of those characteristics, that drive, that determination, the amount of love she had, the selfishness of it too, that facing the battle that she had, and indeed the diagnosis she was given, and to do what she has done in terms of, you know, that national and driving that campaign, and in turn saving the lives of what we can only call thousands of women at this stage. We'll probably never know the full figure, but her work has done, and you know, and going back to her own words that we heard before that piece then from in front of the Public Accounts Committee, that she hoped her death wouldn't be in vain. And as I say, I think she's certainly assured that that will not be the case. May she rest in peace. Time now for a quick break. After that, we will be talking about grade inflation within the third in higher education institutions, with more students securing first-class honours degrees than ever before. And also, we'll be having our Health Matters section. So if you've got a query for our medical herbalist, like so many have done already, please get your questions in on 083 3010 103 by text or WhatsApp, or you can call us here in the station on 0818 300 103. Still to come, Health Matters with Emmett Walsh, medical herbalist, so you can get your questions in there on 083 3010 103 by text or WhatsApp if you'd like us to put those to Emmett for you. Before that though, grade inflation, you're probably familiar with the term. You know the way sometimes these new phrases or terminologies come into our kind of vocabulary, you know, all of a sudden they seem to land upon us, you know, and certainly the pandemic and everything, and if you remember previously from the last recession, the fallout from the, you know, the economic collapse of the banks, and we started hearing things like green shoots and all these kind of phrases and slogans and sometimes jargon that become part of the modern dictionary. Well, grade inflation is certainly one that has entered it recently, and this really stemmed initially from the way the Leaving Cert was assessed due to COVID-19, and it has also transferred into the higher education settings. And recent reports are suggesting that more students than ever are securing first-class honours. Now, I know myself, and when I first graduated, to secure first-class honours was a phenomenal achievement. It did not come easy, and the majority of people that did get first-class honours did so by just a couple of percent, maybe over the threshold that you needed to be in. Such was the standard required and all that kind of thing. So, have things changed? And if so, why have they changed and what might have changed? To find out a bit more about this and dig a little bit deeper, I'm delighted to be joined by Betty McLaughlin. Betty is a former president of the Institute of Guidance Counsellors, and she's a guidance counsellor in Mullingar. Good morning, Betty. How are you?
Good morning, Ronan. How are you?
Betty, is this something that is happening? It clearly is, because there's evidence to suggest that more students than ever are securing first-class honours degrees. Is it happening, and indeed, what might be the, why is the reason? Are we just got cleverer people, or what's actually happening out there?
Well, it's definitely happening. Like, I mean, 37.9%
in May 2022 got first class honours degrees. If you look back in 2020, if you look back back in 2010 actually, to 2011, there was only 15.7% getting a first class honour, you know. Certainly when I was in college, I would say there was only about 5% getting first class honours. So, like, it's definitely crept up. You know, the average of that is calculated, of course, across coursework, presentation work in college, projects and exams. You know, so you need to kind of achieve consistently good grades over all your time now in university. When I was in university, we really had exams at the very end, and I did French and Irish in my degree, and the oral was the only practical we did, and we still did that at the end. So I suppose they have put in more different modules, different types of assessment, and maybe that has led to it. But there is an investigation underway now because, you know, if too many people get a first-class honour, obviously it does, it devalues that first-class honour, no matter what people say, even though it's a wonderful achievement and something everybody would aspire to. But I welcome the investigation, really, because it is very high.
Yeah, I mean, just to put it quite simply, it's the equivalent to an increase of more than 50% in proportion
Absolutely.
Of first-class honours in a seven-year period, which is staggering. And similar to yourself, I remember I would have done my final exams for my honours degree way back in the early noughties, and it was a final exam in all subjects. There may have been one or two small group projects that made up maybe 10, 15% of the overall module marks, but it certainly was, you know, and I know now in comparison to the way things are done now, it is... There's about five or six different ways of assessing students throughout a course. But do you think, is this, whilst it's kind of talking about a seven-year period there, suggesting a 50% in 7 years, do you think obviously the pandemic has maybe, I suppose, you know, changed this because the way in which exams had to be dealt out, particularly online, it just, you know, institutions were trying to react to the situation and the circumstances they found themselves in. Do you think, is that a contributory factor in this?
Well, I'm sure it would be, because if you look, Ronan, during the pandemic, students, and I'm not saying that anything, you know, untoward happened, but they were doing exams from home. They were doing exams online. That's a total new departure from being in a hall where they are being supervised and, you know, where there's time limits and everything there. So the whole thing did change. And if you look at it, those students who would have in May, who would have got the 37.9% of those students in May who would have got their first class honour, they would have been through different ways altogether, entirely through COVID, of sitting their exams, taking their exams, and, you know, a lot of the work would have been online. So when you change a system, there's going to be changes right through. It's a systematic change, and that obviously would affect the way the exams were assessed. A new type of a competition, if you like, you could merely say, and certainly if we're to go by the results, it certainly has changed the outcome.
Yeah, the UK's Education Watchdog has launched an investigation earlier this year into grade inflation, also after witnessing a similar sharp increase. When can we expect this investigation to be concluded, and what would you predict the outcomes might be?
Yeah, I'm not sure, because it's like these investigations take an awful lot of time. I couldn't find, when I was doing my research there, I couldn't find when it's due to finish. All I know is that it's starting, and that will involve a lot of consultation with a lot of different people, with all the stakeholders in the third level system. It'll involve individual colleges who might appear to be higher than others. Like if you look at IDAT in Dunleary, that was the highest number of first class honours. And the thing about that is everything in IDAP, one, to its credit, I would say the majority of their stuff is they do attract very creative people. A lot of their courses are creative, and they would have obviously been project based, so that would have made a difference. And then we look at Manu, and that seemed to be the least and DCU one of the least giving out these first class honours, you know.
Yeah,
until the watchdog does their work, but that would be a very large scale investigation to try and get to the root of that, really, because
you
have to have consultation with every stakeholder, including students who sat the exams, you know.
Absolutely. And just to put a bit of context on it, like the kind of institution that was given out the most first class honours was the Institute of Art, Design and Technology, about 32% of theirs, in comparison to the lowest, which was Maynooth, at about 23%. So there's a 10%, 11 percentage point swing in that there too, which is quite substantial when it comes to first class honours. But yeah, so it'll be very interesting to see what the investigation leads to, and hopefully, you know, will it ultimately determine, you know, or help, will it influence a student's choice of course going forward? I presume it's going to be maybe recalibrated over the next year or so. But I think given the response that institutions have had to make to the pandemic and the complete fundamental shift in how we deliver education now, they probably do need a little bit of time to get that. Would that be fair to say?
It would be fair to say, but I would say to any students out there who have completed their exam and listening, fair play. It was a great result to get. And the second thing is, I would also say to students who didn't get a first class honour, really, employers are not just looking for the grade. It might get you up the line quicker for an interview when they're shortlisting, but certainly when you come in, they're looking for transferable skills, soft skills, being able to work with people. They're looking for you to show evidence that throughout your time in college, what other extracurricular did you take part in that would have developed these skills that would be transferable now into the workplace. So they're not just looking for the grade when they get you in. They're looking when they interview you. They're looking for other things as well. Other skills, any work experience that you have, that will influence as well. What placement did you do during your course? What did you learn there? So it's not just all down to the grade. And people interviewing, employers in particular, will tell you that they will absolutely look for more than just the grade. They want to see what skills have you got. Can you work with people? Are you creative? Can you work on your own initiative? And what work experience can you bring to the that we won't have to handhold you when you come in, and that you'll be able to get on with the job? So it's not just about that. So anybody out there who hasn't got a first class honour, many people with less than a first class honour, with a 2-1, a 2-2, even a third class honour, can do far better in an interview than somebody with a first class honour.
Absolutely, I think crucial.
Heart over that. It's important to say that, I think.
I think so, and I reiterate those sentiments. A crucial bit of advice that often the certificate or the parchment at the end is just that ticket in the door to an interview. It's really down to soft skills and attitude and everything from beyond there. But wise words as always. Betty McLaughlin, thank you so much for giving us that update this morning. Betty, of course, is the former president of the Institute of Guidance Counsellors and is currently a guidance counsellor in Mullingar. Time for a quick break. After that, we'll be joined by medical herbalist Emmett Wald. So continue to get your questions in on 083 3010 103 by text or WhatsApp, powered by the home of Offaly's top-selling car brand, Lambrothers Toyota, on the Arden Road, Tullamore. Or give us a call on 0818 300 103. Welcome back to Midlands Today. I'm delighted to be joined in studio by Emmett Walsh, medical herbalist, for our Health Matters section. And I'm also joined online by Kira O'Mara, medical herbalist and geneticist. Very good morning, Emmett, and a very good morning to you, Kira.
Good morning, Ronan.
Kira, we're going to begin with you today. You have a very interesting topic that you would like to discuss, and it's around how herbs might influence gene expression in humans. I suppose to begin, can you give the listeners an overview of what gene expression actually is?
Okay, so I guess on a day-to-day level, gene expression is, I guess, how our bodies react to and deal with our environment. Genes influence everything from our nervous system settings to, for example, our ability to be able to tolerate caffeine or not tolerate caffeine, and be able to take certain medications and not take certain medications. And they can have a huge influence on our health, obviously. From the more obvious things like cystic fibrosis, which we know is associated with gene abnormalities, to less obvious things like maybe people who have issues with their mood or issues with asthma or eczema or things like that. So one of the areas that I work on in my practice is I'm looking at an area called nutrigenomics, which is basically the study of how both herbs and foods can influence our gene expression. So what I mean by that is how herbs and foods can either help or hinder our health outcomes. And so our gene expression can be influenced by a number of things. It can be influenced by food and herbs. It can be influenced by our environment. And by that, I mean, you know, what you're exposed to, what you're inhaling every day. Do you live in a city? Do you live in the countryside? Or even our psychological and emotional wellness. So we know that our psychological and emotional wellness can, in fact, influence our health outcomes. It can affect our digestion, our mood, our sleep, and all of those factors.
On a very kind of generic level, we definitely, you know, we become more familiar through, you know, various media channels and newspapers and advertising of hearing about things like gut bacteria. Is it something that most people are maybe not acutely aware of the importance of?
Yes, I think so, absolutely. And, you know, there are a couple of things I think that are responsible for the poor state of the bugs in our tummy. One big thing is too much processed foods and sugar in our diet, which is, you know, not supporting the right kind of bacteria to grow in our gut. And also the reduced amount of soluble fiber that's in our food. So not enough vegetables, not enough fruits, too many of the white foods, as we call them. And I mean, there are even some really fascinating twin studies that show that twins who are separated at birth and brought up in different environments will have different health profiles. So one might gain weight easily and not be able to digest certain foods, and another brought up in a totally different environment may have, you know, no issues in that regard. You know, and we know there's been some interesting studies out lately. I know pomegranate juice is something that's becoming quite popular in health circles. And we found that in order for you to actually get the benefits of pomegranate juice, you have to have the presence of certain bacteria in your microbiome to be able to gain that benefit. So, you know, there again, that's an example of how our environment can, you know, influence our health outcomes.
Would it therefore, you know, does it transpire then that, say, for likes of ourselves living in the Midlands of Ireland, if we were to try and use pomegranate juice as part of our diet and we don't have the correct kind of genetic makeup to really get the benefit from it, is that linked to our the environment we're in? And should we therefore be looking at more locally produced, I'm thinking things like beetroot or something like that?
Yeah, so it isn't linked to the environment we're in so far as, you know, we're talking about the foods that we eat. So yes, environment can be a factor, but if we're not supporting the growth of, you know, a good diversity of probiotics, so that is the thinking now is that it's not necessarily so much about the quantity of probiotics, but about the diversity. And so somebody who has a well-balanced diet, who's having a daily bowel movements and is including, you know, good quality soluble fiber in their diet, you know, all things being equal, should have a good spread of probiotics in their gut.
I'd like to bring Emmett Walsh in on the conversation as well. Emmett, when Kira refers to herbs that can help influence gene expression, what type of herbs and are we generally talking about as well? I'm sure it's a vast and wide-ranging list of potential herbs.
It is. The herbs, all herbs can influence gene expression. All food can influence gene expression. All thoughts can influence gene expression. So it's a vast area. So all we can do is just give examples. You know, pertinent to the topic today, which is herbal medicine and health and that. But, you know, for example, it's going to be a little bit controversial. But one of the areas that that gives us a lot of frustration is that we know, we as professionals in herbal medicine, we know that that we can play quite a significant role in helping many types of conditions where people are hospitalised and requiring intensive care of various types, and we do for certain know that in the area of cancer that there are many things that areas that we can help in, and there is pretty much there's a policeman there blocking all entry.
Yeah. Sorry, are you talking at the point maybe of the delivery of the acute care at that stage, or is your intervention best from, say, like a prevention as opposed to cure approach?
It would involve everything. We can support these patients to help tolerate their chemo. That's one example. We can support the patients by actively giving them herbs, which is going to improve many of their organ functions, most specifically the liver, which is the one that's most challenged in many conditions. there's lots of areas that we can play a role in, but we're prevented from doing it. And we're prevented from doing it primarily because of this thing called not introducing bias and standardisation of experimental techniques. So it's research methodology we're talking about. And I would strongly object, and I've said this many times in this programme, that it is not right, it is morally not right to do that. We should be able to help the patients in a way that we know. That there's no point in the oncologist making the call because they're not qualified to make the call. We're the ones that are qualified to make these calls, these important calls to help the patient. And we take the Hippocratic Oath the very same as they do. And we're never going to do anything that's going to harm.
So this is really to help the patient, to help their body cope with the impact that, say, chemotherapy or radiotherapy is going to have on them. It's kind of it's as much an assistance really like to it, or is that what you're suggesting?
One area. The other area, of course, is we can help to improve the person's general health. It's, you know, if for example somebody has cancer of the breast, well, there's lots of other areas that we can help with. As I said already, we can help to improve liver function. We can help to improve kidney function. We can help to improve, most of all, and Kira was making reference to it a few minutes ago, digestive function. So these are critical areas. All ancient peoples believe that all disease occurs fundamentally from a disharmony within the gut. That's the first area that goes awry. And after that, then anything can happen. It's a domino effect.
Are you noticing, are people getting more in touch or more curious about the benefits or potential benefits of herbal medical herbs, you know, over the past number of years? Because, I mean, look at even today, cancer, cervical cancer is right in front and centre again. As you said, Vicky Phelan's passing as well. Are you noticing more people getting inquisitive about medical herbs?
Not really, to be honest, because people are afraid. You know, the people going for treatment, they're afraid to talk of herbs. It's well known. The medical profession has studied this. They know that about 60-70% of patients who are being treated conventionally for cancer, they know that these people are also taking herbs. But the people are afraid to mention it to their doctors. They're afraid. And that's a researched fact. It's not coming from us.
Kira, is that something that you would see happening too?
Yeah, I'm glad I was mentioned that, because I think herbal medicine can have a really supportive role in cancer treatments. And I think we're probably way behind the curve here in Europe. If you look at Japan, if you look at China, they are, you know, it doesn't have to be black and white. It doesn't have to be either or. We will always safely prescribe herbs when somebody is taking conventional medications. In Japan and China, they are prescribing herbal medicine alongside chemotherapeutic agents. And what they have found, and what has come out with a lot of the studies using medicinal mushrooms like turkey tail, reishi, things like that, is that these medicinal mushrooms can not only reduce side effects, but they can also have a synergy in that they allow the chemotherapeutic agents to work even better. So, you know, and my experience echoes that of Emmett's, that patients are afraid to speak to their oncology team. And I always encourage them to do that. But what happens is that there is a general, you know, lockdown and said, no, don't take anything, without any understanding of the logic, the safety, the reasoning behind why we're, you know, prescribing or asking patients to take certain things alongside their mainstream treatment.
My guests on Midlands Today at the Minute are Emmett Walsh, a medical herbalist at Roscorra Clinic in the Blue Ball, and Kira O'Mara, medical herbalist and geneticist. We're going to take a quick break now, but after that, I'm going to put some of your questions to Emmett and Kira there. If you want to keep and get more questions in there too, you can please do so on 083 3010 103. That's our text and WhatsApp number. Talk to you very shortly.
Health Matters on Midlands 103 in association with Haven Pharmacy, Butler's Burr. For confidential pharmacy advice, let Lean Butler, third generation of the family, and his staff look after you and your family. Find Haven Pharmacy Butler's Burr on social media. Expert care made personal. Midlands 103.
I'm joined for Health Matters by Emmett Walsh, medical herbalist at Roscorra Clinic in Blue Ball, and by Ciara O'Mara, medical herbalist and geneticist. We have some listener questions to put towards Emmett and Ciara. Emmett, one that came in there via WhatsApp has been a woman whose friend has cervical cancer. The oncologist has stopped chemotherapy as it's leaving her too weak. Is there anything that can be done to maybe assist her?
Well, I just would not have enough facts to be able to call this one. So in situations like this, what I always say is the person has to make an appointment so that we can explore what's going on. But just a quick comment. The caller said that the chemo was stopped because basically the patient couldn't tolerate it. 80% of the reason for stopping chemo is because of liver toxicity. So this is an area where medical herbalists can play a very significant and important role. Now, at this point, I don't know what stage the cervical cancer is at in this person that their friend phoned in about. There's so many things I just don't know about. But it's one, as I said earlier, it's one of the things that we actively play or can play a very significant and important role in.
Is
that we can help.
Is specific to
every case is specific, but well, we can help the person to cope with whatever chemo that they're taking.
Another listener has asked, could Emmett be asked about a remedy for recurring sinus infections?
Recurring sinus infections, okay. Clear the upper respiratory tract. Use old-fashioned steaming hot water in a basin, a drop of some of the essential oils, towel over the head, stay there for 5 or 10 minutes and do that every morning. And put some kind of nasal drops into your nose to help stimulate further clearing, and take internal herbs for the upper respiratory tract, like thyme especially. Bronchostop is a good one that's available in chemists and health food shops.
Another one has come in from the listener as well. It's about pain in the shoulder and a tingling going down to the hand. Now, this person says they're waiting to see a neurologist, but they're looking for a potential remedy to ease the pain in the meantime.
Okay. What I would be doing is a holding operation at the minute. I would give the person a poultice to put on the shoulder, and I would give them something for pain and inflammation. And I would be intending waiting on the report from the neurologist to see what's going on. There could be something going on in the neck. There could be a kind of narrowing of one of the junctions in the vertebrae in the neck, which is causing a nerve to be squeezed. And this can send pain down into the shoulder and tingling down the hand. We just have to wait and see.
Another listener said, is there anything that he can do for them? They have a pain for a long time now and they can't take much more of the pain. It's going into the groin and the back of the legs and just down to the knees too as well. They said their doctor is a bit mystified as to what might be causing it. Again, is there any potential remedies that might begin to ease that pain?
We would need to await further examination of this patient to see what exactly is going on. But it sounds like hip degeneration. I don't know.
And again, look at the general team to be people just looking for those kind of some remedy to try and take away some of the pain there too. This time of year, with the weather being, we'll call it unseasonably mild as well, does that throw up other kind of illnesses or infections for people that mightn't be normally commonplace?
You know, people always say that you need cold to kill the viruses. I often question that.
Yeah.
I don't really buy into it because When the early spring comes and the wind blows from the east, people get more infections, and it's usually cold.
Absolutely, yeah, and you can see that today actually, even with the temperature is that little bit lower, but it'll probably don't. There seems to be tummy bugs and headaches going around everywhere with the kids when they go back to school. But Emmett, thanks as always for your input there too. Hopefully those answers as well will help those listeners out too. But if people want to get in touch with Emmett, they can do so at Roscorra Clinic on 087 261 3042. As always, Emmett Walsh, thank you for your time this morning. We are approaching 11 o'clock here in Midlands 103. We'll be going to news very shortly, but coming up after 11, we'll be speaking to a senior inspector in the Office of Environmental Enforcement at the Environmental Protection Agency around basically the role that the vital role that local authorities are playing in protecting the environment. They've carried out over 205,000 inspections in 2021, majority of which relate to waste management. So we'll bring you more detail on that after 11 o'clock too. Lots more to come here on Midlands Today between now and midday as always. Happy to have you as part of that conversation. We will also be looking at phone chargers and indeed the dangers that they can present around the house. And just anybody, God knows we all have enough chargers for so many devices these days. Earlier this morning, I made reference in the newspaper section to a report from the Environmental Protection Agency that kind of gave a bit of a rating as a performance of many county councils right across the country. It listed some of the counties that are performing very well and some that are performing in the not-so-well categories. Kildare, Dublin City, Leitrim, Monaghan and Finglas performed the best in 2021 at contributing to national priorities around waste, water, air and noise and relevant government processes. Some of the counties around the Midlands didn't feature so well on the list, but one aspect of it as well that really catches your attention in the EPA's 2021 report that's been published today. It's titled Focus on Local Authority Environmental Enforcement. It identified that water quality around Ireland is declining and the number of water complaints increased by 14%, up to 3,600 complaints in 2021 alone. I'm delighted to be joined now by Valerie Doyle, Senior Inspector in the Office of Environmental Enforcement at the EPA. Valerie, is there any more particular kind of information from this report that you think would be important for listeners to know?
Good morning, Ronan. I suppose a bit of context here is the local authorities, they really play a vital role in protecting the environment, and they're responsible for so many areas, and they actually carry out over 200,000 inspections a year, which is vast. But this report here is not looking at the numbers of inspections. It's really looking at how the inspections and the follow-up activities are delivering on the key environmental areas. And as you mentioned there, important things like waste management, like water quality and things that lead to air quality also. And what this report is, it's new. It's the first time it's been done this way. And it is focusing on the outcomes, as we say. So the assessments have shown really that no local authority is performing brilliant in everything. There's a variation around the country, but most local authorities are performing well in some things. And in the whole area of waste, for example, we're seeing some really good work on illegal waste activities and follow-up there. But in the area of segregation of waste, it's just so important for the circular economy that, you know, that we don't waste good materials that can be reused. And this is particularly important in the commercial waste area and also in commercial industry, commercial sector, and also in the building area in construction and demolition waste. So the recycling there at source is really, really important. From the water perspective, as you mentioned, yes, it is disappointing. Water quality is in decline, and it's really, really important for everything we do. Good water quality. So there are things that local authorities inspect in that area, including things like farm activity and septic tanks, for example. So yes, we are calling for an increase in inspection in that area.
How active are inspectors at present, like on things like septic tanks? Because again, around the Midlands, yes, a lot of houses would be on a traditional septic tank. How active are inspectors in that area?
The inspections, I suppose, are active. Yeah, there is a number of inspections that are happening in the Midlands, and then they're generally happening. What's really, really important is to follow up. So if any of your listeners have an inspection and there's a fault found, if it's not followed up, well, we're not going to get an improvement on the ground, on the environment. So the follow up is really, really important, Ronan, to get the results.
And again, there's other areas too that this brings up. Because again, when you talk about things like waste handling and waste segregation, you would expect that the local authorities are the best organisation to try to promote that message, because they will deal with from businesses right down to individual homeowners.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. And we are seeing a lot of activity in waste. Waste is the highest level of activity of inspections out there. So there is definitely activity happening in that area. Sometimes it's difficult to focus. So this report is trying to focus on key areas where we can make improvements.
Has this framework for assessing the performance of local authorities, has it been in place for long?
So no, it's brand new, Roland. This is the first year of it. We have been measuring the performance since, I suppose, 2014, but in a very much concentrating before on activities and doing inspections and doing enforcements. So the framework has been revised now, and this year we're really looking at the results of those inspections. So, for example, are they happening in the right place? Locally, is the local intelligence used to do the inspections in the right place? And particularly then, are they followed up so that issues are resolved and the environment is improved?
Yeah, it's very important to set a series of objectives and metrics around them, and at least then you can follow up and review and see where progress goes too. So what kind of measures are local authorities in typical, say around the Midlands, what might people expect to see happening over the coming years as councils look at improving our water quality, improving our waste management, etc.?
So they will see very much targeting inspections in the area. We talk about water and air quality a little bit. So in the water quality side of things, the rural counties you're talking about, so they'll see a more consistent approach to farm inspections. They see that they're happening on a risk-based in high-risk areas, but also in areas where you've got good water quality to make sure that is protected also. But also to see where issues are found, that they are actually followed up on, and local authorities do have the powers to do that. In the water area or in the air area, there's been recent legislation come out just the end of October for air quality for the selling of smoky fuels. So only approved fuels now can be sold nationwide, whereas before that was restricted to a number of towns and villages around the country. So they will see, when they go to the retailers, that they'll only be able to buy approved fuels.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot more awareness now around the use of non or smokeless fuels too, which certainly all helps and contributes to the overall air quality. And it's a circular process. Every one action in one area inadvertently helps the other area too. But Valerie, thank you so much for your input this morning, and well done to the EPA, I suppose, and here's to your continued good work on that such vitally important aspect. Indeed, highlighting the important role that our local authorities play around all environmental matters. The full details of that report, that first report, the focus on local authority environmental enforcement, are available on the EPA website. It was just published today, and it is a very comprehensive report and breaks down all the stats and figures that Valerie has just touched upon there. And again, it kind of supposed the message is there. We can all play our own roles in dealing with waste management and climate action, and indeed how we just manage on a day-to-day basis that can have a positive impact on our environment overall. Stay tuned. Still to come here in Midlands today, we're going to talk about how phone chargers could present a danger in your house. You mightn't be expecting it, but some phone chargers, or certainly situations they're used in, could be potentially very, very dangerous in a household. And also, if you have a firearm and you have a license for it, it may need renewal, and Sergeant Graeme Cavanagh will be along just to talk us briefly through that process. So, lots to come here on Midlands today. Thank you to everyone who was text this morning just paying their own tribute to Vicky Phelan, the cervical check campaigner who sadly passed away yesterday. Those tributes have continued from all across the country too, and even throughout media, from everybody from President Michael D. Higgins to senior politicians to people who knew her. And what really is jumping out and is beyond doubt is that anybody who got to know Vicky Phelan in any capacity really was absolutely astounded by her strength, by her resolve, and indeed by her just sense of good humour and the resilience that she showed in dealing with her diagnosis, and but not just dealing with it, but using it as a platform to speak out nationally and in an attempt to save the lives of thousands of other people and to make sure that the mistakes that had been made were not repeated again. One person who I'm sure was very fortunate to get to know Vicky Phelan was local Tullamore artist Vincent Devine. And Vincent, as you know, painted the incredible portrait of Vicky. It was a very personal project for Vincent and indeed for Vicky. And Vincent joins me on the line now. Firstly, Vincent, I'm sure the news that greeted you yesterday was sad, to say the least.
Yeah, I suppose like the rest of the nation, it's hard-hitting. It's a time we all knew was coming, but I suppose the people like us that knew her closely didn't really want to believe it was coming. I mean, sometimes we all thought she was kind of invincible. And that news yesterday, I spent yesterday kind of in deep mourning because I got to know the essence of who Vicky was. I mean, she allowed me access to her soul, essentially. And what I found there was just this absolute beauty of spirit and human endurance. And I'm going to miss her terribly. But there was a torch passed yesterday. And that's what myself and David Brennan will be doing with the portrait now. It will be keeping Vicky's voice alive and using the portrait to make sure that the things that happened don't happen again.
One of her missions was to save lives, and in an article actually back in January this year, you said the painting will, as you say, the torch has been passed, the painting, you intended to do the same thing. You captured the essence of her in that picture. What was that process like? How did you really get in deep with her and develop that rapport and relationship?
We had to like each other. It was very simple, Ronan. It was a case of, you know, the initial meeting in the studio and then figuring out if we liked each other, and we just hit it off straight away because she, I suppose, knew she could trust me with the story of her life based on seeing how I painted other people in history. And I was very aware of where she would come in the history of this country, which is For All the Women, and what she has done, and the men as well, to support these women. So the process essentially was to get to know each other inside out and then paint her from the inside out, essentially. And I was just proud at the fact that she was proud. And I spoke to her about 3 weeks ago, and just to check in with her to say, Vicky, are you happy with the tone, with everything I'm saying? And she said, Vincent, I am 110% behind you, and you just keep going because I don't have the energy to do it anymore.
I'm sure listeners are familiar with the painting. It is a triptych. It's a three-panel painting of Vicky depicting her past, present and future. What were the key attributes, those essence of her soul, as you put it yourself, that you really brought into your painting, and how did you go about doing that and representing those in a visual format?
We basically sat down for hours and hours and hours, and she gave me an insight, like I said, into the depths of her soul, who she was as a person, into her psyche, into things she thought that other people would wonder but never get to know. And it was because I had access to so much information and so much personal information that I was able to handle it with the integrity needed, just like handling her children in the painting. I mean, that's the two things in her hands. The bird is her daughter and the sapling oak tree is her son, Dara. And in the portrait, this surrealistic seascape set in Doonbeg, where she essentially is going to have her ashes scattered, she would be doing nothing else other than holding those kids in her hands. So it was a collaboration with the two of us. And she was able to look through the notes I made and what I intended for the painting and to basically greenlight most of the stuff in it to say, here's what I would like and here's what I maybe don't like and here's what I want hidden. So it would kind of stay hidden until eventually down the road, if change is not made, Vincent, I want you to come out and say this in maybe 10 years' time, 20 years' time.
Wow. Well, to have that presence of mind, you know, going, given what she was going through at the time, is phenomenal. Was she directly involved then as you painted the picture, or did she step away and leave it over to you and then only see it when you unveiled it?
No, she knew some of the stuff that was going into it. I sent her the photograph of her face because it was quite hard to achieve, because I got to know the kind of private Vicky who, you know, no makeup around the kitchen, plodding around, doing the things mothers do. You know, and then I would know the public Vicky and see her at events and see her on TV. So I would say, I sent her the photograph of her face and she said, no, I think you really have the essence of me and maybe you might lighten this side up. And, you know, so she was very, very, very involved, actually. And some things that I had said to her, oh, maybe Vicky, I might not put this in. She said, no, Vincent, you are 110% putting that in and that's all there is to it. So I had to figure out a way to put it in for her. But this is how involved she was in the painting and why she stands behind and stood behind it so much, because she knows the power of what we can do with this.
Yeah, and she, you know, she was an amazing woman because she really opened up her life to get that message out, you know, speaking about her family, about the horrendous effects the disease was having on her body and on her psyche and everything. And now to have gone a step further with you and for you to have created that is fantastic. I mean, for people that, you know, just to know, the painting was sold in February 2020 in a worldwide charity auction. It raised a staggering €58,000. And again, that money went towards Heroes Aid, a charity which provides financial aid to frontline workers. So even in the time, you know, the money that was raised is going towards charities too. Where is the painting now?
Paynton is with the owner who purchased it at auction in Shepherd's and Duro. So David Brennan is the man who purchased it. He's a childhood friend of Vicky's. And the intention in the purchase was, first of all, to give charity, and second of all, to bring this painting around the country to help to carry on the campaign that Vicky was too unwell to carry on herself. So the painting is now touring around different universities in the country, and we are trying to use this visual language to express how people should be speaking and how they should be talking about their bodies and in the proper language, and, you know, being aware of their bodies and, you know, basically trying to get the good side or the better side of a diagnosis, so you can actually prevent the cancer or prevent something that's going wrong in your body, so nobody has to end up the way Vicky did. First of all, due to negligence, and second of all, maybe with other people just not keeping on top of their physical health and their mental and emotional health. So we're just trying to kind of raise the awareness so women will go and get their smears done. And this is what Vicky was passionate about.
From your perspective, you know, of having got to know her so intimately, what will her legacy be?
I mean, her legacy to me personally would just be this absolute beauty of spirit to a person who endured, never gave up, really, for her children. And then for the national, you know, for in aim of national awareness for all the women. I mean, you have to remember as well, Ronan, I mean, when she stood in the steps of the High Court, that could have been my daughter in the future, my daughters in the future, or it could have been my mother, or it could have been my grandmother. So, I mean, she leaves behind this thing with me of always speak truth, be the truth in the world, and don't back down. And that kind of carries over, I think, to the legacy she leaves across the country, is she went up against a system that normally people would be too afraid to go against. And that stands for a lot. And she will forever, forever have changed the landscape of medical history and the history of the spirit of this country. She was an absolutely incredible, incredible woman.
Vincent Devine, thank you for that. And I mean, you are in that unique position too of, as you say, been getting to know her so intimately, getting to know the essence of her soul, and then to be able to translate that into the stunning painting that you produced is absolutely fantastic. Vincent, thank you so much for coming on to talk to myself and the listeners of Midlands 103 this morning. I know it's a deeply sad and tough time for you, but thank you for that.
Thanks, Ronan.
That's Vincent Devine there, the famed artist from Tullamore, who got to know Vicky Phelan in you know, creating that fantastic painting. And you just get a sense of what that process was like and how deep and meaningful it was for Vincent and indeed for Vicky. Again, I just say may she rest in peace, and continue, if you would like to send your tributes into her here on 083 3010 103 by text or WhatsApp. Lots of you have so far, and I mean, such has been the impact that she had. She touched so many people's lives, because I think behind it all, yes, she was so prevalent in the media, but her story was so real. It was so raw. It was a real story of a normal person who unfortunately had circumstances thrust upon her that, you know, could have been done. Things could have been done a little bit different, and maybe it couldn't have happened. But as Vincent says, you know, maybe the legacy there will be that it doesn't happen to people going forward, and what a legacy that would be to leave behind. Time now for a quick break. After that, we're going to be talking about things like gun licenses. We'll also have an update on that, story that maybe Ireland might have 7 games in Euro 2028 once Cabinet approved that. How exciting might that be? Or is it something that you think we should forget about and we should put the money elsewhere? You know, I know there'll be a benefit for the economy, but at what cost as well? Let me know your thoughts. 083 3010 103 is the text and WhatsApp number. I'm delighted to be joined in studio now by Sergeant Graeme Kavanagh. And Graeme's here to talk all about firearms and renewal of licences. And really to issue a reminder that firearms renewals issues 3 months in advance of your firearms licence expiry. And the onus is actually on the holder to renew immediately and not delay. Graeme, an important topic, I'd imagine. Is there part of this that maybe people may not be aware that there is that 3 month renewal period?
Yeah, in fairness, now, the one thing I don't want people to think that I'm coming on to give out, we have in excess 230,000 firearm certs issued in Ireland. In Laois and Offaly, we've in excess 20,000 firearms holders. And I've yet to come across one of them that doesn't take the security and storage of the firearm seriously. The paperwork side of things sometimes falls down. When your firearm cert is due to expire, you get a pre-populated form, if you're a current firearms holder, 3 months in advance. So it's kind of like the NCT. And the important thing is that when you get that piece of paper, generally all it needs is for you to sign it and drop it into the local Garda station, because there's no changes. Sometimes there are changes, like you might have moved the GP from the medical side of stuff, or there might be different referees, or maybe a change of landowner, and you need to put that detail in, sign the form and drop it in. Unfortunately, what happens is people get the piece of paper and it's left on a shelf, and next thing, it's the 3 months has expired, and you're left in possession of an unlicensed firearm, which is an offence. It's illegal.
And that is therefore subject to seizure.
Exactly. And I mean, that's the last thing we want to be doing to people, but we can't ignore it either, you know. Yeah. And it's not an age thing. It's sometimes people just get caught up in day-to-day life and they forget, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I spend part of my role is calling to firearms holders to assess the level of security, and they take it seriously, you know. So it's just, I suppose, really what we're trying to do is get that conversation going, remind people, you know, when you get it back to us. There's a process that has to go through then that has to be sent to Dublin. You then get a piece of paper that you bring into the post office and you pay for your firearm and you get your licence back then.
If you miss that period, your firearm therefore becomes unlicensed as well. Are you then into a whole new kind of reapplication process? Is that, that's, I know it typically happens with lots of other those letters that you forget.
Yeah, you can renew your license after the 3 months, but the problem is that that date, it's like the NCT when you renew your, you know, you lose that. So it's not like you're going to get another 3 months at the end of it, you know.
Around the whole the firearms licensing process as well, is there limits on the number of firearms that an individual can have licensed?
Every individual is assessed on what they need the firearms for. And in fairness, quite a lot of men and women would be going out and shooting internationally or shooting at clubs. So every case is determined on its individual needs.
There is, of course, new minimum security standards that will be required of licence holders now, particularly in relation to the provision of secure accommodation for their firearms. So who can apply for a training certificate in relation to this?
So between 14 to 16 years of age is the age that you can apply for a firearms training certificate. And then after 16, you can apply for a firearms licence. That's part of the work that we do as crime prevention officers. Once you go over a certain number of guns, we would be tasked going out to assess that you have you put in place a security accommodation. So there's two statutory instruments, and I know people, you can look them up yourself, because like this is the thing, all this information is on the Garda website, the FCA1, which is the firearms application form, a copy of that. So if you're looking to get a firearm for the first time, a copy of that form is on the Garda website. You fill it out, you drop it into your Garda station. Advice about what you do next is on the website too, a step-by-step guide. The commission has guidelines about it, but it's a bare minimum that the secure accommodation is, you know. So it's something you need to take seriously if you've got firearms on board, you know.
Yeah, one listener has texted in just to ask, is there a medical required? But again, I assume that information is probably available on garda.ie.
Yeah, there's a reference to your GP, you know, so you have to be able to show that you're of good health.
What's the duration then of the firearm cert? I think you mentioned, is it 3 years?
3 years, yeah. And I mean, the one thing I remember when it came out a number of years ago, it went up to €80, and that actually put off quite a lot of people. And there was quite a lot of firearms handed in then and subsequently destroyed, you know. But it's €80 for 3 years.
You can give us more information there as well. But there is, you know, it's all based on the Firearms Act, but basically Garda.ie is the main place for that as well. Is one FCA1... application completed for each, I suppose, each firearm held, or is it just one?
Each firearm.
Okay.
Each
firearm. And thank you, because and should there be do people need to attach like copies of passports, driving license to an application?
No, it says that on the form, and in fairness, at the back of it on page 11 or 12, there's a checklist that you go through and you can self-check that you've attached the photograph. You know, sometimes every time a new firearms FCA renewal comes in, you might need to attach a new photograph, you know, if you're a bit older, you might have changed a slight bit of appearance, you know. That might need to be attached. But the important thing is for people is that more often than not, you don't need to do anything, only just sign that form and get it into the Garda station. And that's the bit that falls down, you know. So that's the, I suppose that's the key message today, is just get people to do that piece, you know. We have, like I said at the start, we've over 20,000 firearms applicants or firearms holders in Laois and Offaly. We have firearms officers that work in Bore, Tullamore and Port Laois. And their full-time job is to process them and get them in speedily. So when there's fall down or when there's an issue with an application, it can slow it down for other people, you know. So it's an important, the system works, it does have its issues. We are constantly striving to improve that. But by far, I speak to people, they get their application in and they get back the firearms license very quickly.
One listener has just asked as well that they, if they're a member of a gun club, say like a gun club or a clay pigeon club, as opposed to a rifle or pistol club, where on the form FCA1 can they accommodate their membership details?
Just write it onto the form, an available spot on the form.
Perfect. And a final one there as well, kind of a similar one. If someone is a member of a gun, a game or other gun club, do they also need to provide written permission from two landowners?
I would believe they do, yeah.
Okay. And again, more information on that on Garda.ie there. But as Graham says, the main message there is just to make sure that there is an advance renewal period there, that you have to meet the criteria in that and get your licence renewed as well. Graham, this time of year too, I suppose, dark evenings, early mornings, when it comes to, I suppose, security around the house, business as well, what are Gardaí promoting at the minute?
So we're still using our tagline, lock up, light up. And I remember at the start of the autumn, we were got an energy crisis and using lighting. Lighting is still an efficient way. It's still cheap. LED lights, you know. Using your alarm, making the place look occupied, you know. There's one little area that we're kind of concerned about, and it's not the first time this happened, because I've spoken about this before over the last number of years. We have got our bogus callers. You know, the people that call around offering to do trades and services. Yeah. And I know there was a case there that received attention there over the last week, where a number of people are being brought before the courts for a large sum of money taken from a person. But the same message. If somebody comes to your home offering to fix something, you're in a better position than anybody else to know what needs to be fixed. You don't need some stranger to come and tell you it needs to be done. If they do, don't engage with them. Just walk back in, call ourselves, call a neighbour. And there's another area that is a worrying development, and it has happened over the last 7 or 8 years. We've certain criminal groupings that are calling to older people and more vulnerable people, and it's not happening night time. It's happening during the day too, in daylight hours, where they're purporting to be members of Mary Garda Síochána, and they're telling them, I think you're at the post office at the bank there today, and we're investigating counterfeit notes. Can you show us the money that you took out of the post office there you got to today? And the person will show them the money, and they'll say, yeah, they're counterfeit, and they take the money from them. The real important message is, and Garda Síochána doesn't work that way. We don't call to people like that, you know. If we believe you've got counterfeit money, we'll generally get a warrant and we'll come and search for that, you know. Yeah, we don't call to people's houses.
It's a time of day where people are vulnerable, because maybe, you know, if they have family, they're possibly at work, or kids are in school and stuff, but also a generation of people who are deeply trusting of like Garda Síochána. So as you say, if it looks unusual, just ask those questions as well.
Yeah. And for us, the message we're trying to get out is that if your mother or father or aunt or uncle are living alone, or you know, and they don't listen to the radio, you know, is to have that conversation with them, you know. We try and get this information across all media means, but people don't get the message sometimes, you know. Is to have that conversation, you know, mom or dad, like if you're out there and somebody calls, you know, you don't have to answer the door every time, you know. Have a look out, you know. If they say the regard, we don't get offended if people turn us away, you know. Like genuine trades, people, if they're asked, you know, we'll come back again.
Typical potential security measures for maybe a vulnerable older person like that as well. What can they, is there things that can be installed, or I suppose what are the kind of the steps they should follow then? As you said, you don't have to let a guard in, you know, you're happy to be turned away if necessary.
Yeah, we'll come back. I mean, that's part of our role. I'd rather somebody turn me away than to let the wrong person in, you know. Simple things, the senior alert alarms, dependent on the necklace. If there's a problem, they press the button. There are, I suppose, the monitor doorbells, that sort of stuff. It's cheap. An effective way that you, from away from the home, if somebody comes to their front door, you can see real time what's going on, and you can hear what's going on, and you can react to it, you know. The cheapest and freest way is not opening that door and locking it, you know, locking the front and the back door, you know, having a look out the window, see who it is. If you don't know them, you don't have to answer it.
Yeah, the message is the same really for, isn't everything we do, like earlier in the show, we're saying people about, you know, the be careful about going online to buy products. We spoke about dental treatment, people coming back from Turkey from some rogue clinics with no teeth or €25,000 bills, you know. The question is, you know, if you're going looking at something, so if it seems suspicious or too good to be true, or you know, suspicious, maybe you should say, don't open that door in the first place, or don't click on that website as well. Sergeant Graham Kavanagh, thank you as always for your advice. And again, as Graham says, if you have got people who may be vulnerable during the day as well, and they don't listen to radio, make sure to get that message to them, and that it's okay not to open that door, and maybe don't always trust the person that's there. If you have a little bit of a suspicion, trust that. Trust your instincts, and let somebody know. Let the Gardaí know. Let a relative, let a neighbour know, and hopefully that will prevent you being exposed to potential crime. Thank you as always to Graham Kavanagh there too. After the break, we are going to look at that whole potential and possibility that there may be 7 games from Euro 2028 featuring or played in Ireland between the Aviva Stadium and Croke Park. I don't know, I think we know the last big frenzy that happened in Croke Park. This is a slightly different kettle of fish, one I would very much welcome, but I'd love to know your opinion on this. So get involved in the conversation. 083 3010 103 is the text or WhatsApp number. Midlands Today is hitting the road tomorrow as Lindsay Dolan brings you the show live from Longford and Westmead Education and Training Board's Further Education and Training Centre in Mullingar. She'll be checking out the wide range of blended and on-site courses available at the centre, and she'll be chatting to the management of LWETB about the courses and what the centre can do for you. Also there on the day, you can meet Midlands 103's featured friend, Ollie the Owl, plus there'll be fun and games for all. That's Midlands Today, live from LWETB's Further Education and Training Centre in Marlinstown Business Park, Mullingar, 9 to 12 tomorrow. Now, David Hollywood, our sports editor, joins me in studio. David, news emerged this morning that Ireland is in a joint bid to host Euro 2028. We may be getting up to 7 games, potentially. Tell us more.
Yeah, so I think many will remember that Ireland were expected, rather selected, to host Euro 2020. We had group games and a quarterfinal lined up. The dream was that Ireland would be playing at it, and then Ireland failed to qualify for it. And then the pandemic struck, and then we couldn't meet the capacity requirements of the Aviva Stadium because the UEFA wanted at least 25% capacity for those, and the Irish government couldn't fulfil that. So the Aviva and Dublin dropped out. Ever since then, it's basically been expected that a joint bid involving the Republic of Ireland with the likes of England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland would likely be accepted by UEFA at some stage. And they've gone for Euro 2028. The likely rivals here in terms of the bid are Turkey. The way it would set up is that the Aviva and Croke Park would host up to 7 games, Ronan, as you said. Potentially 120,000 fans would travel to Ireland for the tournament. Wales and the Principality Stadium in Cardiff is being talked about as a possible opening venue. Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland would have one stadium each. England would provide up to 6 venues, which include Wembley, the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, London Stadium, which is where West Ham play their games, Old Trafford, the City of Manchester Stadium, Everton Stadium, must be the official name. That's Goodison Park to anyone wondering. Yeah. St James's Park.
One, though, yeah. There was talks about them building
You know what? Yeah, they've been desperately trying to get a new one done.
One potential positive in this, I know people are going to be kind of very cognizant of cost and all that. It's not Qatar, where basically you go and build 8 or 9 world-class stadiums where there's no professional soccer teams. We have the infrastructure already, so there might be small investments in, you know, maybe fan facilities, that type of thing.
Yeah, fan zones, policing will be a rather big one. Ronan, you're quite minded around economics and business. So 120,000 fans coming to the country, in economic terms, that must mean something pretty substantial.
Sure, look what we can do in a day of the ploughing championships. We can put 120,000 people in a field in rural Ireland. So like we bring it on, we can do that as well. David, the big question is, if this goes ahead and we're successful in this joint bid, will all the nations qualify automatically? Because normally it's only one, maybe two host nations.
This is the issue. There's a couple of different approaches that UEFA could take in this issue or in this regard. 5 host nations, they're not all getting in. That is the truth of it. So it may be done based on ranking or previous qualification campaigns in the European Championships. But the good news is, with the exception of England, we're ranked well ahead of the rest.
OK, bring it on. And will John Delaney be at the opening ceremony? Oh, I didn't say that, did I? I think
he'll have his own procedures and processions to go through at that stage.
I think this is fantastic news as well, and a great chance to showcase, because in fairness, the Aviva and Croke Park are two absolutely stunning and world-class stadiums. Yeah. David Hollywood, thanks for that, and hopefully we hear some good news on that in the coming weeks and months anyway. That's it. Look, it's almost time to bring the show to a close today. Thank you for all your contributions to the show, and to all today's guests, and particularly to Vincent Devine for paying such an emotional tribute to Vicky Phelan earlier. The little piece we were talking about regarding phone charges, we've had to put it off until maybe tomorrow's show, so it will be covered at a slightly later date. I'm out of the hot seat today. Lindsay Dolan, as I've just said, will be with you tomorrow. She's out and about in the LWETB on an outside broadcast.